You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Very excited to record this podcast from my home, for those of you viewing. That's why you don't see the Second City stuff behind me. We're talking to Scott Barry Kaufman, who needs no introduction on this podcast. He's been a frequent guest, the most frequent guest on the podcast, and also a partner as he co-hosted our limited series podcast, This Might Get Awkward, last year. He is the author of many books, and he's a scholar who uses mentalism as a vehicle for awe and transformation. Chris Shipley has documented, influenced, and predicted the impact of technology on business and society for 40 years as a journalist, industry analyst, entrepreneur, and business strategist. Together, Scott and Chris have co-edited the new book, Leading for Tomorrow, Unlocking Human Potential in the Era of Continuous Change and Endless Possibility. Enjoy the pod. Scotty, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, yay. Hey, so good to be here.
Great to be here. Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to have you here. So in the new book, you write in the introduction about how in the early 1930s, nearly 90% of America's urban households were electrified, but that it would take another 30 years and an act of Congress for electricity to reach most, but still not all, of the country's rural and remote homes. And then you note that, quote, leaders directed people to perform known tasks toward known outcomes, and generally, that leadership style worked until now. So what's changed?
Well, we look at that kind of adoption curve as a way to sort of point out just how fast the market is moving. When you think about that, 100 years later, you get the iPhone. It only took a couple of years to get to that kind of penetration. And now, literally billions of queries are being fed into AIs every day, right? So we've things are moving too quickly. And when they move that fast, it's really just hard to understand what the outcomes might be or what, even what you're asking for. And so if you're leading to a specific outcome and you don't know what that outcome is, you're going to have to think about a different way to get to where this destination unknown.
Yeah. So there's speed. There's also the fog metaphor comes up quite a bit in the different essays, and I'm curious about the origin of this book, because clearly, I mean, a lot of the authors, they're not saying the same thing, but they're singing from the same hymnal. Scotty, like, how did this all come together?
You put it really so well, and I also want to say, you know, Chris and I are really here representing over 20. Amazing leading thinkers of our generation who are all united in this vision of a human-centered leadership future and really want that future to come about. We're all part of this group called the Silicon Guild, which up to now has been a secret society, basically. and we're like, let's come out, you know, and do like a project together, really kind of. And I will say this project really has rallied us all, or connected us all in a way I haven't seen so much in the group in the past. So it's been there's great energy for that. But that is the thing that unites all of us. And we had this idea to do a collaboration with Thinkers 50 because there's a lot of members of the Silicon Guild who are also ranked as one of the top business leaders. Thinkers 50 does this ranking of the top 50. Ironically, Chris and I never made the ranking, and we're the editors of the book. So it just goes to show you can find alternative pathways to success, maybe, other than being ranked. But with that said, a lot of the members of the book are Thinkers 50, And so we're doing this great collaboration with Thinkers 50 as well. Kind of bringing together everyone who's on this vibe, this frequency. And the real focus there is human-centered leadership, how to keep that in an age of continuous disruption. Because we're living in this age where it feels like every day a new news headline is coming out telling us that what we thought about the old way in the workplace is wrong, and now it's this new one. But it's getting like every day there's a new detour that we're taking in the workplace. So what can remain? You know, what can be the solid rock and things like trust and things like, you know, trust in your leadership. You know, these are things that are going to be so important. Creativity and dignity. You know, as you read in the chapters, these are things that unite all of them. Chris, what have I left out here?
No, I think you capture that. For the last 150, maybe even longer years, we've had an economy that's based on wringing out value from resources, right? So how much, what can we do with our natural resources? How much productivity can we get out of people? We call them human resources, right? So we're extracting value from the worker. And I think that we're coming to a natural end of that kind of very explicit, you know, we've wrung everything dry, right? So mm-hmm. if that's the case, then and we think about where are economics going, we have to start thinking about how do we create new value together. And to do that, you don't wring out resources, you nurture them. And that takes a really different style where you are leading with grace, with humanity, with an understanding that together, collectively, we can do so much more than just sort of, you know, beat the drum until everybody steps in line and performs. And I think that's really the shift that this whole book talks about. Like, as these new technologies come along, as the economy changes, as people change, people embrace their agency, what does it mean to put humans at the center of an organization and lead them to this co-created new future?
It probably won't surprise you to know that Second City has been getting called quite a bit to address this issue, wanting us to work with the human teams on how they can, you know, be better collaborators, be more creative, be better storytellers, all the most human aspects of the things that they do, knowing that they are going to be working with this technology. And one of the things that's been really interesting for us is understanding that, and this goes both for being comedy theater and also an improvisational theater, which is we're really good at using wrong. Like, mistakes are the best for us. They're funny. They expose sort of new interesting patterns. They take us to interesting places. And the one thing so far that is my experience with AI is AI doesn't use wrong well. It gets stuff wrong, but it doesn't draw insights from that. And I think that when we talked about the fog idea, I feel that's kind of like where, you know, humans maybe will have a little bit of the advantage of how to work through that. Does that strike a bell with either of you?
Yeah, I mean, I love that framing, right? That wrong is really where the value comes from, right? We often talk about, failure is a point of learning, right? It's not, oh my God, you're too screwed up and you're fired. It's, this experiment didn't work. How do we rethink that? And we have a wonderful chapter actually in this book by Amy Edmondson, who talks about we have to start leading like scientists. And scientists have hypotheses. They do experiments. Sometimes the experiments fail. And it's not like, oh, well, we blew it. It's, okay, what did we learn from that? And I think that I love the framing of what do we learn from wrong? How do we use wrong to get to some better place is just brilliant. And that I think is very much at the heart of this.
Yeah, being wrong is so human too, and I've gently pushed back against optimization bro culture in my recent Substack writings. I think there's some wisdom there. I'm not hating on it, but I think a complete picture of humanity needs to recognize there's value to not optimizing all the dimensions within ourselves, but discovering the unique shape of our soul and leaning into our most unique, valuable contributions. When you get too focused on optimizing the whole system, you become a machine and you can lose your self-actualization. And so That's my gentle pushback of the optimization sort of world. You know, in some ways, yes, I want to optimize my maybe my sleep, my calorie intake, but what does it mean to optimize my love? You know, my relationships at work. What does that mean to optimize my relationships at work? What does that mean? You know, like, what does it mean right. to optimize my purpose? You know, what would it mean for me to have an optimal purpose? You know, that's mm-hmm. not. So, you know, I think there's some things that we want to give to the machines. Yeah, fine, good. And there are things we want to be able to keep for ourselves.
Chip Conley has a great line where he says, quote, in the past few decades, many of us have been smuggling consciousness into the workplace. And I love that because it was a little bit of like a, you know, I don't know if a dirty word is quite the way to say it, but certainly not something that a lot of people want to talk about. And what this book overwhelmingly shows us is those that we're going to have to talk about love, trust, meaning, purpose, all those things, because otherwise we are ceding to the robots. And I don't think anyone sort of thinks that is going to be, you know, the right move.
Yeah.
There are a couple of guys who think it's the right move, but yeah. Well, not most of us.
Fair enough. Yeah, most of us. There for are tech sure. bros who think, yeah.
But I really want to just double click on Chip Conley. You know, his idea of the wisdom worker was a deliberate play on Peter Drucker's term, the knowledge worker. Which Drucker coined in 1959, yeah. by the way, for the information economy. So I think that I totally agree that we need more, especially as AI becomes more and more good at providing knowledge for us. We're going to need the humans to sort of be able to have the wisdom on how it's being used, right? And how it's being shared and distributed. You know, you need some humanity for that. So,
well, and there's a conundrum in that too, Scott, because you know, we see so many people talking about, well, we're going to use AI to do all these like entry level jobs. And so new coders, we won't need those. We won't need young engineers anymore. Or we won't, you know, we'll have AIs that are better diagnosticians than doctors. So we won't, you know, need young doctors anymore. And the thing is, how do you have to go through that phase yeah. to get to wisdom? So I think what it really calls on us to do is really think about not how does this technology replace entry level tasks or these early learning experiences, but how do these tools get used to help accelerate that learning and that path to wisdom? Because if we remove workers, we remove people from this sort of early career development stage, and then expect them somehow to magically show up equipped with the wisdom of the experience to be real leaders, they haven't had any learning ground for that. So it does call on us to really think about how do we use these tools in a smart way so that we can accelerate learning, not replace it.
Yeah. So this was a conversation I had last week based on this podcast, which is, I always read the book. I underline the book, or if it's in my Kindle, do the thing there. And then I do my notes. So you can see I type out all the notes. And I sort of realized, Claude could actually do that for me. But if Claude does that for me, am I doing my learning? Because the gift of this, one of the biggest gifts of this podcast is every week I get to have a really interesting conversation over material that I have processed in a variety of ways. And then it's a real learning loop. And if I take that part away, I know you talked about early stage learners for sure, but also I'm a late stage learner. I want to keep learning, and I want to add to my ability to really understand the ideas that are being presented. So, you know, we've got to look at this at every level of an organization where it works. And I'm not an AI doomer. Like I think that I've already seen terrific ways that it can help in our business, Second City. But very little of that is any what I'll call creative work. That's not where it is. We've seen any sort of value. I don't know if that's going to change. I really don't think anyone wants to come to Second City to see an AI comedy show. Someone's going to try.
It's going to happen. You know it's going to happen.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be good.
I was working on a project and we decided we would do a joke book. What's so funny about AI? And so I asked Claude and ChatGPT and others to write 100 100 jokes about, and I gave him the scenario. These are the most god-awful jokes. I think, Kelly, you and your colleagues are safe because AI has no sense of humor.
No. The robots have yet to be funny. This has been going on for a while. We've been involved with projects for 30 years where, you know, we were working with IBM at one point, trying to help them teach this robot to be funny. And, you know, they can tell a dad joke. But I think we all know the reason they're called dad jokes is because they're not funny. Scott Anthony has a really good essay in here, and he has a line where he says, quote, "A wise leader listens to the voice that doesn't speak." I want both of you to respond to what you think that means.
Can you say that one more time, Kelly? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So Scott Anthony writes, "A wise leader listens to the voice that doesn't speak."
That's so wise. That's so wise. A lot of people in this group, by the way, I love that came from Scott Anthony too, from what I know about Scott Anthony and his wonderful way of being. A lot of people in this group, they are more quiet leaders, and they show more of these quiet strengths that illustrate that leadership is not always about making the decisive decision for everyone. You know, I think that when you think leadership, you kind of conjure up that idea, right? Sometimes the best leadership is the kind that has the capacity to truly soak up and listen, you know, observe and listen to the needs of your employees, as well as the needs of who your company is serving, and figuring out really clever ways of bringing out the best in everyone so that goal is realized. But the ego of the leader just doesn't matter in that equation. You know, it's the goal is, you know, let me really put my ear to the ground here. That's my interpretation of it from what I know about Scott Anthony. What do you think, Chris?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, he's really saying that there's so much information and knowledge and wisdom that comes from things other than what we say. Right? It's watching how people interact, watching behaviors, looking at mood, evaluating facial expression. All of those things go into kind of really understanding a scenario, and they're not they're all very human things, right? If I say, "Hey, would you like to go out tomorrow?" and I'm shaking my head no, I'm giving you a message, right?
Yeah.
If you say, "Hey, I've got a job for you," and I grimace, I'm sending a message. And I think, you know, it's becoming more open to the invisible messages or the less clear messages that actually create these more meaningful interactions and build real knowledge and wisdom. I think that's where what he's getting to, is that it's beyond just, you know, my own experience, my own assumptions, my own way of thinking about it. Let me just impose it. But it's about taking in more data, more information to become wiser in the kind of decisions you make.
That was really well put.
And it connects to something that John Haidt and Caroline Webb write about in their essay, where they say, quote, "None of us ever sees the full picture of anything." And this is, if there's one thing that I wish I had understood earlier, it's just how little any of us are seeing of a full picture. I remember I was listening to like a history podcast where, like, you know, when they talk about these battles, like, everyone is, it's entirely guesswork, because if you're in the battle, you're not seeing the whole thing. And no one, especially in olden times, was like above seeing everything that was happening at the battle. So it's kind of guesswork. And every day, we, you know, we're making assumptions, and some of those might be sort of correct. But I think that idea that, because John and Caroline also talk about practical humility. And I think that is a call in this book across every page, which is like, look, you have got to practice humility in the face of a speedy unknown, right?
Yeah, I think so. And their chapter is so important right now in this moment, because they're really talking about all of the things that divide us are some of them are very real things. Some of them are a whole set of assumptions and points of view and life experiences. Again, you don't see the whole picture. And so you go deep into your silo and you get dug in, and then you just become combative rather than being able to lift your head up and look around and be more cooperative. And I think they have in that chapter really captured this moment and the need to lead differently, especially for organizations and leaders who find that they are leading people of different political backgrounds or interests or, you know, socioeconomic positions, all of the whatever side of you're on, right? And uh-huh. and how do you bring those people together to work together when the starting point is, oh, I don't like you, or I don't like the way you think, or I don't, right. you know, I don't know you, I don't understand you, so you must not be right. You have to change that narrative. And I think they provide some really wonderful insights about how to do that.
Agreed.
This book is surprisingly optimistic.
Yeah. Not if you know the Silicon Guild folks.
Well, no, this is my question for you. Like, okay, so you're a bunch of smart folks. The world seems very complicated, very dark, very scary. And yet, like, you've got some optimism, like things are going to work. Where does that come from? How does that play it out in these conversations?
Well, I would say it's just very authentic. Right? I think that mm-hmm. there's no one among these contributors who sat back and said, what do I think it ought to be?
Yeah.
But rather, what's the experience that I'm having? What have I observed and learned? And where is my wisdom? What does that suggest? And I think it's optimistic, absolutely, and also filled with humility. Scott and I have talked about this as the editors. Yeah. I mean, these are really incredible people who raised their hand and said, yes, I'd like to contribute a chapter. And one of my early reactions was, holy hell, how am I going to edit these people? They're brilliant.
Yeah. Right?
And yet, to a person, there was a compassionate, human, humble, how do we make this better? How do we work together? How do we contribute so that this project is successful? Because this is a message that needs to get out in the world. How can I be helpful in that? Rather than, you changed a comma in that sentence, and I really am not happy with that that edit. It was more, hey, that's great. We're together. We're getting better. And I think, again, and they're just, it's modeled behavior because it's who they are.
Oh yeah, I've never met such a selfless group of humans in mass in my life. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much so many years, like, I've been with this group, and this is just, it's like our conversations we have just put in a book form. It's like a great continuity between our internal email list conversations, and we're like, oh, let's just put this into a book, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. A third of these folks have been on the podcast. A couple are good friends of mine. And I agree. It's a terrific group. One person I didn't know is, and let me know if I'm pronouncing their name correctly, Chris Yeh.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. Who wants to, I am kind of obsessed with the perfect map paradox. Can one of you describe what that is, or do you need me to talk it up a little bit?
I think you should tell us your perception, and I'll try to interpret what I think Chris was saying.
Which one is this?
This is the perfect map paradox, and the idea is that the only way a map is perfect is if the map is the same size of the territory it maps. But if that's the case, it's useless.
Right.
Because you need a map to be able to hold to navigate. So I love this because, you know, we're constantly in a war against perfect in my field, because there is no such thing. And this kind of speaks to why that might be the case, because if it is perfect in this paradox, it's like that phrase, true but useless.
Well, yeah. I love what Chris did in his chapter, because he told a story about being a graduate student at Harvard Business School and learning all of the theory about how to run a business. At the same time, he started a company and was running a business, and seeing all the places where, you know, on one hand, there's kind of an ego is, hey, listen, I'm a Harvard Business grad. I know how to do all this stuff. And the other hand is like reality saying, no, it's not going to work that way. And his need to reconcile those things and to understand that what you think you know in theory and what you have to do, you have to understand in practice, can be really different things. And that can be really painful. But it's also an opportunity to really kind of, again, embrace your more human self, recognizing that the maps, if you will, that were, you know, presented in the classroom aren't necessarily perfect when you're trying to do something in you know, the real world, and that being able to kind of navigate off map is critically important.
Yeah, this phrase from the book stands out to me, from control to curation. And I think we're just going to have to relinquish like control in this age. And that's really hard for a lot of people to do, you know, and they're not seeing what's really coming. You know, I see it. I see it. I mean, I get it. I get it. I talk to Claude every day. I'm like, okay, I see you, buddy. Mm-hmm. I see you guys coming. But so we're going to have to relinquish control quite a bit as a species, and allow for, our talents of curation to come out. And it's curation of human potential. It's not creation of AI potential. it's given the AI potential. How can we curate, environments where, you know, I think this is where my neurodiversity drum gets banged a little bit. You know, we need it. We're going to need more and more of an appreciation of neurodivergent humans in our species.
I think another thing that a word I want to talk about with both of you is transformation. So this has come up on maybe the last six podcasts. And so, you know, in our field, in Second City specific improvisation, we are trying to attain transformation on stage. And it's either transformation of a character, a scene, an idea, transform the audience in some way. If we're not doing that, we're not really succeeding. We're not playing to the top of our intelligence, the work that we do. We had Joe Pine on the podcast who coined the term the experience economy, and his new book is called The Transformation Economy. And that and this comes up too in the book. Sanyin Tsang says the act of sharing knowledge is not just informational, it is transformational. So when we're talking about transformation in this sort of leading of tomorrow, what does that mean to both of you?
Well, here's the thing. I absolutely think there is this transformation, but there's an idea where I think implied in transformation is we started at point A and we transformed and we've arrived at point B. And I don't think we're arriving anywhere anymore. I think we're changing all the time, but we're in this kind of very long hallway of liminal transformation, right? And we are different daily as we proceed through it, but there's not an end point, right? So I push back on transformation and as the idea that we are here and then we will be there and then everything's going to be fine.
Right.
I think it's, we are always transforming. We're always changing, and everything around us is always changing. And so how do we become hyper adaptive to a world that doesn't stay the same for very long?
I love that. Scotty?
I think it's the word transformation is a deep one for me. And it's one that I sit with a lot when I do, because like I do self actualization coaching and we want to transform the client. But what we really mean by transform is we want to have we want the person themselves to have a spontaneous insight into who they could become, not for us to transform them. Like I don't think when we talk about transformation in this book and we use that word, it's not that we're like forcing a transformation, but I want us to create the conditions of humanity where people are like, oh, I thought that was my potential, and but I actually see a greater vision for like how I can contribute to society. So for what that would be one concrete example for me of transformation would be for someone being like, wow, I never realized I can really contribute to the humanity pie in that way before, you know. To me that's transformation, you know.
So forgive the theatrical metaphor, but I feel like, you know, we're all living in a show that never closes. And Second City is that. We opened in 1959, and except for COVID, we didn't close the doors. And the shows all sort of segue into each other, and that's just how it's been. And also what we're doing is creating art through improvisation, which is audience suggestion, which is we're asking people for their ideas, and so we are taking account of the room, and we're incorporating that, and that becomes the next show. And guess what? Next year we're going to be still talking to that audience, and they're going to maybe feel a little bit different, or it might look a little bit different. The broad themes are kind of the same since 1959 to now. We're talking about love, we're talking about power, we're talking about status, we're talking about feeling, all those things. But it looks very different, and it feels different, and there's other things around. So I in many ways, and this is something I felt for a long while, which is like the rest of the world is catching up with a thing that we've been doing, and quite frankly, that theater itself has been doing from the reason it started, which was to reflect humanity in a way that we can actually see ourselves, but not through a perfect picture, through allegory, through symbol, you know. And music does this too, and art does this, and it's so you know, maybe part of the optimism is all this beauty that can come out of us kind of looking at ourselves through, you know, this different lens.
Art. Yeah, I just love that you brought up just art in general, and that like a potential, the future of art. And I'm sorry, I know you started to talk there, Chris.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
A lot of people are having that conversation right now about the future of AI and its ability to compose music, could do poems that are going to be more and more human. But maybe some of that misses the point of art. Because this goes back to my earlier point. I think a lot of these days about people who are obsessed with optimization. I don't think optimizing art really does art justice, because the most beautiful art is the type of art that is extraordinarily messy and shows a mirror on the messiness of humans in a way that we can relate to. And I think a lot about that, Kelly. Yeah.
And Kelly, I love the metaphor because of the longevity of it. I just a couple of weekends, I went to a small liberal arts college in Pennsylvania, and we were celebrating the 150th anniversary of the student newspaper. And I was editor of the paper when I was there, and lots of other editors came back. And somebody said this is the longest continuing class project anywhere in the world. Like this thing started 150 years ago, and they actually printed every name of everybody over 150 years who'd been involved in it. And it was just like this really, I thought, really human way to say, it took a lot of people to get here, and where this thing was in 1867 and where it is today, they're really different. But it's this continuity of effort, of art, of communication, of finding and reporting and talking about our humanity that makes it just a really beautiful thing. Right? And I think that's what we miss if we think that an AI can just reach into a language model and by being really good at guessing what words and characters are going to come next, pull something out of our past and say, here it is. We miss that messy middle that you're talking about, Scott. And I think that's what's so important.
I want to yes and you, Chris. I really love what you just said. And I think a lot about what is so special about humans, because I don't want us to think that we're like, oh, we're so special humans, you know, like we're so precious. How dare AI come in? But I do think if there's one thing you had to press me on it that is really unique about humans, and this is something I've studied as a cognitive scientist, that's human experience. That's human consciousness. It's the inner life. That's why all my work, my entire career, is focused on the inner life. It's not focused on, you know, there are people who do it, habits, goal attainment, blah, 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 blah. That's never been my vibe. I study openness to experience. I study the creative flow. And so if you ask me what is unique about, you know, humans, this is what I think we always will want to maintain and keep. The arts is one of the most important vehicles for enriching the human experience that has ever been invented. And even if you do have AI that can do that, it's still AI that's enriching the human experience. It's not AI enriching fellow AI experience, because that's not something AI has yet. I know there's some discussion in the field of consciousness whether or not these AIs are becoming conscious, but they're probably not yet, and they don't have the substrate
of the biological experience that we have right now. So I just want to throw that out there.
You know, I think that what that speaks or reminds you of is the difference between opening up an art history book and seeing the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Mm-hmm. Like, and you can look at that and go, wow, that is incredible. But when you walk into that place and you crane your neck to see this, try to capture this whole thing in your view, and you feel it in that experience, that's the art. You know, that's the thing. And AI will be really good at showing us the picture book, but it's, you know, at least for some time, we're not going to get the experience in the same way. And I think that's why art is so important. And then we hear, I hear, you know, the Department of Education no longer wants to fund degrees that aren't valuable. I'm thinking, who's to say it's valuable? You know,
I mean, that,
let's expand our value, not try to be so transactional that we lose all the relationships.
So here's something sort of so interesting. It's not in my notes. I don't know why I didn't include it or think of it. I got interviewed 3 days ago by the local NBC affiliate because they're doing a piece on the 250th anniversary and they're looking at Chicago innovation. And they want to talk to me about culture in Second City in particular. And so I was talking about how, you know, we developed improvisation as a Chicago-born thing. And I said, the thing that's fascinating is people know that from Second City, but what many people don't know is the origin story, which was these improv games that are the core of all the training were developed by a social worker by the name of Viola Spolin at Jane Addams Hull House on the southwest side of Chicago. And she was using it to better have immigrant children and neighborhood children collaborate. And a lot of the games were in gibberish because the kids didn't always share language. And I said, and the next question, she said, well, when you think about the future, what are you thinking of? I go, I said, you're bringing this up at a perfect time because we just launched a program with a group called Funny Girls where we are doing improv-based leadership training for girls grades 3 through 9 in Chicago public schools. It's completely funded by this group out of New York City called Funny Girls. And they worked with us, let us play with the curriculum a little bit with our knowledge about improvisation. And, it, you know, I think we're going into 7 schools this fall. And I can't wait. And all the kids are going to be able to showcase their stuff at Second City. But it's about you using that experience of practicing in a room with other girls to find agency, to find their voice, to find their ability to tell stories, and then do it in front of an audience, which is going to be scary. And it's like, oh, you're like, what a great coda as you're looking at this, you know, arc of time that this thing started so long ago. And we're kind of still doing it, but in this both new and old way. And I guess that's sort of what you're saying. It's like I don't think AI is not going to understand the poetry of that breath. Is my thought.
Yeah. Well, you know, I talk and I write a lot about being adaptive, you know, and change requires adaptability. What is improv but an adaptation, right? It's responding in the moment. And I think it's such a wonderful tool and technique to really respond to the moment. And this program sounds fantastic. Congratulations for that.
Yeah. No, really happy about it. All right. So we always end the podcast asking our first time guests for a yes and story. Chris, do you have one for us?
Yeah, well, yes. And it's probably less of a story and more just of a way of being. Like I learned early in, you know, I'm not someone who can say, oh, I see the future. And so these are the steps I need to take to get there. But I've been a person who is willing to say yes to just about everything. Mm-hmm. And so my career, my life is not a straight line at all, but it's a series of yes ands. You know, it's like, what do you think? Would you like to do that? Yes. And as we're doing it, let's do this. And yes. And let's go try something else. And so I've been really lucky that I've been given a lot of interesting provocations to be able to say yes to, because it's made for a really delightful career. And, you know, led me to a guy like Scott. So it's been very much worth it to embrace the yes and.
I love that.
This has been a really lovely collaboration. On that note, I just want to say this has been a lovely collaboration. Chris and I it was so natural. Yeah.
So Scott, so we were talking about the fact that you've answered the yes and question. You know, you've been on the podcast, the most appearances on the podcast of any guest.
It's amazing.
Has your, has your understanding of yes and changed in the last, like, we've known each other almost 10 years?
Oh, that's crazy.
We talk all the time. I know. And we talk a lot, and we've worked on projects together. And I will never forget. So Scotty and I had set up just a call. I think we were just like touching base during COVID around that time, in that time period when they stormed the Capitol. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And Scott and I just watched it together for like a half hour.
Can we just watch this together
and see what's going on? So yes. So you've sat with yes and for the better part of a decade. Anything that's changed?
Yeah. I like to have humility and admit, you know, like being a little bit neurodivergent, sometimes I can like say stupid things, you know, like I can, like you've seen it. And so like, I admit it. And I also, this is me playing yes and, because I think there was a time maybe when I was 20, 21, well, in my 20s where I would just have so much social anxiety that I wouldn't talk to anyone because I was so afraid that I would say, because I know that I, like, I'm a very honest person, for instance, and I value honesty, but I also feel like not everyone values my honesty about them. You know what I'm saying? I never quite put it that way.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So I've had to learn that. But yes and has helped me over the years, even since the time I've known you, have more self-compassion for myself. Does that make any sense? Like, you know, be like,
yeah.
Yes, I probably maybe not have should have said that so bluntly. And, you know, I'm learning and I won't do that again. You're like, file that away. That's not the person to do that with. And mm-hmm. you know, I learn and I'm not going to beat myself up. Cause I know, like, I know myself, I know my intentions are good. If that makes sense. So.
Yeah. So I had open heart surgery 13 weeks ago.
You look great.
Right. I know. Thank you. I'm doing great.
He's been through a lot. Chris.
But one of the things I was at a lunch today and with my friends, Jan and Tor, and they were sort of like, so like psychologically, where are you at? And I'm like, I gotta be honest with you. I do not give a crap in the best possible way. I don't know how long this Zen thing is going to last, but I'm not getting myself worked up about stuff that I would normally get worked up about. And it's just like, cause I sort of feel like I already won, you know, I made it through this thing, bought myself some great time. I'm feeling good. And I think it's like, you know, like Scotty, like what you're saying, it's like, it's, we have to yes and ourselves.
Yeah.
We have to yes and our imperfections. Because also that's what makes us us. I don't think I'd be that really interested in a perfect Scott Barry Kaufman.
Well, thank you, Kelly. I do appreciate that. And I'd probably be bored of that. There is a little bit of a Dennis the Menace, you know, person inside me as well that enjoys, you know, if I'm being honest, rattling the cage a little bit. Yeah, for sure.
The book is called Leading for Tomorrow, Unlocking Human Potential in the Area of Continuous Change and Endless Possibility. Scott Barry Kaufman, Chris Shipley, thank you for coming on the pod.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
So great.
Hold on one second, guys. I just got to get this loaded up. Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.